KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, the latest on the U.S. military strikes in Iran. Tehran says it will hold the U.S. accountable for last night's attack on its nuclear facilities.
The U.S. administration holds sole and full responsibility for the consequences of its actions.
And a look at the relationship between the U.S. and Israel and what that may mean for this conflict. Plus, we'll have the view from the Pentagon and a closer look at alliances between Iran, Russia, and China. It's Sunday, June 22nd. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. New details are beginning to emerge about yesterday's U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Officials say the operation involved B-2 stealth bombers and at least one submarine. NPR's Greg Myrie reports.
The B-2 bombers dropped 30,000-pound bunker-busting bombs on two Iranian nuclear sites, Fordo and Natanz. This comes from a U.S. official who requested anonymity. The U.S. has used those planes in previous wars, but this marks the first time these massive bombs have been used in combat. In addition, at least one U.S. submarine fired Tomahawk missiles at a third nuclear site in Isfahan. The U.S. planes flew round trip from an airbase near Kansas City, and the U.S. official said they did not come under fire while in Iranian airspace. President Trump described the attacks as a huge success, though it will take some time before a detailed damage assessment is possible. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Iran retaliated with missile attacks on Israel early this morning. Israeli medics say at least 23 people were wounded. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi reports from Tel Aviv.
Sirens and explosions rang through Tel Aviv as Iranian missiles struck Israel. Medics rushed to the scenes of a high-rise building that was struck in northern Tel Aviv, while others rescued people from damaged sites in the northern city in Haifa. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the strikes on Iran were done with full operational coordination between the U.S. and Israeli militaries. The U.S. struck three Iranian nuclear sites, including the fortified Fordo Mountain facility and an enrichment plant called Natanz. The Iranian foreign minister said it was too late for diplomacy and that the U.S. had crossed a, quote, very big red line. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Many Democrats in Congress objected to Trump's decision to strike Iran's nuclear sites, saying it's Congress's job to declare war. A Kentucky Republican agrees. Karen Czar with member station WUKY reports.
Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey is one of the few Republicans denouncing the move. On X, he shared Trump's True Social post about the attacks and wrote, quote, "This is not constitutional." Last Tuesday, Massey filed a resolution to ban the U.S. from becoming involved in the war between Israel and Iran, saying then, quote, "This is not our war. Even if it were, Congress must decide such matters according to our Constitution." Most Democrats agree. Republican leadership, on the other hand, has rallied behind Trump. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in Lexington.
The National Weather Service has posted extreme heat warnings today from the northern plains to the Midwest. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. A law requiring Texas public schools display the Ten Commandments is set to take effect September 1st. Governor Greg Abbott signed it into law yesterday. It requires a specific version be displayed in classrooms, although versions vary across faiths and denominations. A similar law in Louisiana was ruled unconstitutional by federal courts. Officials there say they will appeal. A British report suggests artificial intelligence is replacing thousands of accounting jobs that once went to entry-level workers. Vicky Barker reports from London.
The so-called Big Four accounting firms, Deloitte, EY, KPMG, and PwC, employ about 100,000 workers in the UK. They're among the country's biggest recruiters of new graduates. Now, new figures from the worldwide employment site Indeed, reported in the Sunday Telegraph, show the number of Big Four job ads for recent high school and university graduates has fallen by 44% since 2023. With artificial intelligence increasingly performing the administrative tasks traditionally handed to entry-level workers. AI's hit job security in the wider industry, too. The headhunting firm Patrick Morgan says job cuts at the Big Four increased with the emergence of ChatGPT in 2022. For NPR News, I'm Vicki Barker in London.
In college baseball, LSU is leading the World Series by one game. If it beats Coastal Carolina University today, it will win the title for an eighth time. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The U.S. has entered the war between Israel and Iran, bombing three Iranian sites said to be critical to the country's nuclear program. That was after midnight local time. Today, the Iranian foreign minister said Iran, quote, reserves all options to defend its sovereignty, interest, and people. He also said the U.S. strikes were outrageous and will have everlasting consequences. We're joined now by Arash Azizi, who's an expert on Iran's Revolutionary Guard and is an incoming lecturer at Yale University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with that statement from the foreign minister. What might all options mean? I mean, Iran is up against two nuclear powers, right?
That's right. Iran does have, you know, does have a lot of options in a way. It could attack the U.S. forces in the region, in Iraq and in the Gulf countries. It could try to close the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, where a lot of the world's oil passes. It could threaten U.S. Ships sort of in the area. Already some Iranian hardliners are calling for attacks in different places. It could theoretically attack U.S. bases in Turkey. But all of these options will really complicate it for Iran. Iran, for example, have had good relations with Turkey for decades. It's not going to ruin that by attacking Turkish territory. And for the Gulf countries, too, Iran has had really good relationship with them for the last few years. And the Gulf countries have mostly, Saudi Arabia and others, have come and condemned the Iranian attacks. One option, of course, could have been using Iran's sort of these militias that are supported by Iran, and that could come into the game, and they could sort of attack U.S. interests, Western interests in the region. But these militias have been really weakened.
Those militias have been limited by all the other fighting in the Middle East, right?
Exactly. They've been really weakened. Lebanon's Hezbollah is a shadow of its former self, and effectively, it has said it's going to sit this one out. The Iraqi militias really don't want to be seen as getting their country into the war. And, you know, this is Middle East. Frankly, a lot of people, I think, have sympathy for Iranians that are, and the Iranian people that are going through this war. But at the same time, you know, if you look at social media or WhatsApp channels between families, a lot of people, you know, they're very clear that this is not their fight.
Well, this strike came shortly after President Trump said he was holding off on his decision so that diplomacy would have a chance. Do you think Iranian officials believe that they had time for negotiations?
Well, I mean, this is the second time that Donald Trump does what is effectively sort of a deception. Of course, in the Israeli attacks also happened just when, you know, talks with Iran and the United States were scheduled 2 days later, 2 days after what became the first Israeli attacks. So there's obviously going to be a problem of Iranians trusting the United States, but at the same time, they have few options. I mean, the big grand option here is Do they want to start a protracted war with the United States and Israel that will go on for long, that will have devastating consequences for Iran? Or do they want to really seek some fundamental way out? Not negotiate a little here, a little there, you know, do a little gesture, but to say, look, we are here for something big. And frankly, Donald Trump said unconditional surrender. It is going to look like some sort of a surrender at some point.
From Iran, you think it will look like a surrender?
I mean, it has to in some point. But, you know, I speak as an Iranian, patriotic Iranian.
But can I ask you, the U.S. bombed Iraq in 2003, accusing it of having weapons of mass destruction. That, of course, turned out not to be the case. What lessons do you think Iran took from that time?
I think, you know, if Iran, looking at that time, you know, U.S. was, U.S. didn't just bomb Iraq, but invaded Iraq and really sort of, it ended up regretting it. Everybody across the spectrum, of course, famously, including Donald Trump, really regretted that. The lessons Iran learned from that is that it could, the attacks could happen, but that the focus of the superpowers will be gone and the forces in the Middle East will remain and they can drag U.S. and others into sort of a quagmire and win the game in the longer term. I think that's one conclusion they can have, but it will have devastating consequences for Iran as it did for Iraq. So I believe some sort of an attempt for peace would make a lot more sense.
That's Iran scholar Arash Azizi. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. For more than two decades, he was a State Department Middle East analyst, advisor, and negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
So the New York Times headline is U.S. Enters War Against Iran. For Americans listening at home, is the U.S. at war?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. In fact, the real question is, are we headed to an all-out war, that is to say, an extended confrontation in which the Iranians, using their asymmetrical instruments, proxies, missiles, terrorism, will strike U.S. forces, bases in Iraq and in Syria, Americans deployed in the Gulf, oil infrastructure, price of oil has gone up 10% since over the last 9 days, U.S. only gets 3% of its oil from the Gulf, but others do. Chinese are dependent on it,
and oil is set on a global scale. So I mean, if it gets affected, it's hitting everybody.
Right. So look, you know, my take on this is pretty clear. You know, attacking Iran is not a Nike commercial. It's not let's do it. The reality is, when America goes to war, and let's be clear, we are at war with Iran, it needs to ask basic questions. Can we do it? And by the briefing I just heard from JCS Chairman Kane, President said we've totally obliterated Iran's the three sites. Kane was much more withholding on this. He said they've been severely damaged. Can we do it? Should we do it? What'll it cost? And what's the end game? And I'd only point out that this region is literally littered with the remains of great powers who believe they could impose their will on smaller ones. Iran is weaker than it's ever been, and it rolled the dice by advancing its nuclear program beyond levels way beyond the Iran nuclear agreement, and the IAEA is convinced that 19 out of, 35 countries censured Iran for basically violating their agreements under the NPT. So I think we're headed for not all-out war. This is not Iraq. It is not Afghanistan. The U.S. is not going to deploy hundreds of thousands of forces to fundamentally change the regime or to ensure that it can't rebuild its program. But we certainly are not headed anytime soon for serious diplomacy.
Can you talk to me about that? Because you've been inside administrations. Like, who is talking to whom right now? What are the back channels? And who has the power to de-escalate this at this moment?
You know, there are three core actors in this combustible situation, and only three, in my judgment. You have Washington, president, and his national security team. You've got the Israelis, and you've got the mollocracy, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. Those are the core decisions. I suspect the Saudis and the Omanis are sending all kinds of messages to the Iranians about the need for restraint, about the need to try to figure out how to create an off-ramp. But 2 months was spent. And at the end of the almost six rounds of negotiation, the basic bridge between Iran's demand of the right to enrich uranium and the Trump's decision to say there will be no enrichment, that bridge was never constructed. And frankly, I've been around negotiations for a long time. I think you could have gone at this for another 2 months. You still wouldn't have gotten there.
Does the U.S. have the diplomatic capacity at this point when you've had, you know, so many agencies gutted to really do something like this, to pull off a de-escalation or to pull off an agreement like this?
It's will and skill, Aisha. It's will and skill. And yes, the answer is, you know, I've worked for Democrats and Republicans. I voted for Democrats and Republicans. I'm certainly no fan and advocate of Donald Trump for any number of reasons that have nothing to do with foreign policy. But yeah, the reality is even with a set of advisors who actually don't really advise, they intuit what the president wants, and then they try to give him what he wants. But I think, yeah, I think, but again, the question is, can you find the off-ramp that they searched for 2 months, and in the wake of these strikes and what the Iranian response may be, it's going to be very difficult to put Humpty Dumpty together again and to construct all the pieces of a functional negotiation. I hope that somehow materializes, but I don't have real high confidence.
Quickly, how do you assess the risk to American safety right now?
I think you've got to assume worst case. You've gotten battened down the hatches at diplomatic installations. American citizens need to be advised wherever they are, and certainly American forces in the Gulf, the 40,000 we have, the 2,500 in Iraq, the near 1,000 deployed in Syria. You've got to assume the worst case until it proves otherwise.
That's longtime Middle East negotiator Aaron David Miller. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. More details are emerging about the U.S. strikes in Iran yesterday. Air Force General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says initial assessments indicate the goal of the mission was achieved, that three Iranian nuclear sites were destroyed. The Israeli military says it's recovered the remains of three people held after the attack on Israel on October 7, 2023. They'd been killed during the attack and the remains recovered in an operation in Gaza. And the U.S. heat wave is spreading from the northern plains to the Midwest today and to the East Coast later this week. Millions of people are under extreme heat warnings. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. President Trump's decision to bomb Iran will all but surely go down as a defining moment of his presidency. The consequences of American strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities will be felt in the region and beyond for years to come. Daniel Shapiro was the U.S. ambassador to Israel during the Obama administration and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East under President Biden. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
I have to ask you, was bombing Iran last night the right decision?
You know, I think there could have been a bit more time for diplomacy. Obviously, even President Trump seemed to indicate that the initial 60-day window he had made for the talks, he had additional talks extended out beyond that. The Israelis came to him and said they don't think they can wait any longer. And he had an opportunity to give the Prime Minister of Israel a red light and say, not now, I need more time, but he didn't do that. But once we were in that situation, I think this was likely to happen. Actually, I do think those talks were likely to produce a crisis and that this was basically inevitable. I thought it would come a little later in the year. But because of the way the Iranian program has advanced, the IAEA has documented that they were at 10 bombs worth of near weapons grade uranium that they could enrich all the way to weapons grade very quickly. And they were making progress on weaponizing, that at some point, this is just too close for comfort for a country that has sponsored terrorism, that has directly attacked Israel twice in the last year. To allow them to sit at that threshold of nuclear capability.
Now that it has happened, what do you think comes next from Iran? Because, you know, President Trump is saying make peace or face more attacks. Iran is diminished because of the war in Gaza. Its allies are now not at the capability that they were before. It has issues, but is it going to strike back? And what could that look like?
So Iran certainly is weakened and certainly is capable of striking back. Both are true. I think what's always been true is that the Iranian regime prioritizes the preservation of the regime more than anything. This is not about regime change. It shouldn't be. No U.S. official that I know of has said that's the goal, and I don't think we should get pulled into that. However, what President Trump said last night was important, and I think it was reiterated at the Pentagon this morning, which is that if Iran chooses to attack or use its proxies to attack U.S. forces in the region, U.S. personnel, or even our partners and allies, particularly in the Gulf, there's going to be a very strong response to that. There needs to be a strong message of deterrence. And there's a way that they, if they need to respond, and they probably do, they can do it in a more symbolic way, a way that puts us on a de-escalatory path rather than an escalatory path. Just remember in 2020, when President Trump ordered the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the IRGC commander, Iran did respond, but they responded with one strike on one base. There were U.S. wounded in that strike, but it sort of brought us toward a downward stream on that conflict rather than escalatory one. So that's what we need to get them on.
How can you get to an agreement or this de-escalatory phase if there's no trust between the two sides?
It's difficult, we'll need help. We'll need help from our European partners. We'll need help from our Gulf partners. They all have different kinds of relationships with Iran than we do. But there's also an opportunity to, as we sometimes say in diplomacy, expand the pie, right? It's, instead of just coming to Iran and saying, now capitulate, now accept all the terms you wouldn't accept in the previous negotiations, which they, of course, will need to accept, there are other things that can be done. They could make some additional commitments about ending their support for these terrorist organizations, but in return for that, there's an opportunity for greater sanctions relief for them. And sanctions relief could be very valuable to a regime that's under stress, that is concerned about how it's going to survive and how it's going to present to its own people that they got something for all of the trouble they've put them through over the last several decades, really.
Quickly, is there a danger that Iran and other powers in the region will now think they must get nuclear weapons?
There's always a danger that people will view nuclear weapons as the capability that makes you invulnerable. But in a way, that's why this had to happen, because if Iran had crossed that threshold, we would find ourselves with a country we really could not control and respond to in the same way.
That's Daniel Shapiro, former U.S. ambassador to Israel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
The repercussions of last night's U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities stretch far beyond the borders of Iran, Israel, and the region. Moscow and Beijing could prove to be consequential in this moment. Nicole Gryevsky is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Nuclear Policy Program, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with Russia. Its security relationship with Iran has deepened in recent years. What can you tell us about that?
Well, certainly the Russia-Iran relationship has grown exponentially since the war in Ukraine with the provision of Iranian drones to Russia. You've also seen Russia and Iran cooperate in Syria in 2015. Of course, that collapsed this past year. But the Russia-Iran relationship is robust when it comes to military technical cooperation. They have no kind of clause that binds them to mutual aid when it comes to defense matters. But in terms of Iran's missile program, Iran's conventional program, Russia has contributed quite significantly to some of the technology behind that.
And what about Iran's relationship with China?
Iran's relationship with China is primarily more economic focused. China is one of the largest investors of foreign direct investment in Iran. They have quite a bit of investments when it comes to Iranian ports. And of course, China imports a lot of Iran's oil through teapot refineries. And so that relationship's quite crucial when it comes to the economic dimension.
What do you think in this moment that China may be trying or may try to help get supplies to Iran or do things, kind of back channels to help them in this moment?
It's unclear. I mean, there's been reports of some transport planes flying into Tehran, but those haven't been confirmed. I think at the moment, Iran's needs are much more about determining its future and where it's going to go. And China and Russia actually play a pretty important role when it comes to the diplomatic side of it. And certainly the Chinese are concerned about this escalation and, you know, with some threats to close the Strait of Hormuz, that would really impact China's economic interests, not only in Iran, but in the Persian Gulf. So right now, I think what you're going to see is both the Russians and Chinese trying to at least support Iran when it comes to international forums like the UN Security Council and trying to de-escalate the situation.
What have Beijing and Moscow been saying about the U.S. strikes on Iran?
Well, both Beijing and Moscow came out with pretty strongly worded statements that condemn the strikes. At the moment, actually, we've seen that the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, has announced that he'll be traveling to Moscow tonight to discuss consultations with Vladimir Putin, potentially on a UN Security Council draft to end the hostilities. And so it does seem like Iran's leaning on them. They've condemned the strikes quite profoundly.
Neither China nor Russia, both of them nuclear powers, have militarily intervened so far. Is there or was there any expectation in Iran for them to step in and help them militarily?
No, as much as the tension has been on the Russia-Iran relationship when it comes to Ukraine or the Russia-Iran-China kind of triangle, decision makers in Iran had no illusions about the extent of their ties to both Russia and China. Neither country has offered Iran mutual aid or assistance when it comes to military matters. And so their contemplation about going into this with Israel and kind of these exchanges really weren't hinged on its ties to Russia and China.
Well, Russia and China have each tried to kind of counterbalance the West with their influence and power. Is this an opportunity for them to try to kind of throw that weight around?
I would say so. I mean, I think the narrative coming out of this, especially in the global South, really panders to the kind of worldview that Russia and China have sought to create about this anti-Western multipolar order. And so they've been capitalizing on this to kind of draw together a coalition of states that are against the United States. They're also might potentially use this for horizontal escalation and view this conflict as kind of a way to distract from other issues like Ukraine, for example.
That's the Carnegie Endowment's Nicole Grajewski. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
The picture that's emerging of the U.S. actions against Iran last night is one of a complex military operation with the details closely held. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is learning details, and he joins us now. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Ayesha.
So you're just back from a briefing at the Pentagon. What stood out to you this morning?
Well, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Dan Kane briefed. They said three nuclear sites in Iran were hit. There were more than 125 aircraft in this on this mission, including B-2 bombers dropping multiple so-called bunker busters. The first time this GBU-57 was used in combat. Also, Ayesha, a submarine was used as well, firing several dozen Tomahawk missiles. And there was some deception as well. Some of the B-2s flew west from a base in Missouri over the Pacific. Everybody was watching that. This was a decoy mission. The B-2s attacking Iran flew east over the Atlantic, refueling in midair, and then joined by fighter aircraft once over land. Officials said Iran was caught completely off guard. No shots were fired at U.S. aircraft. Iranian planes did not take to the skies, and no Iranian missiles were fired. Now, Secretary Hegseth said this is about degrading Iranian nuclear programs and not regime change. He said it's time for Iran to seek peace and come to the table. A big question is, what happens if Iran does not come to the table or drags out talks with European officials? Clearly, Israel will continue attacks, but will the U.S. mount additional strikes if Iran does not seek peace? And also, this mission is called Operation Midnight Hammer. It was very closely held. Congressional leaders were only notified after the attacks were over. Attacks that took about 25 minutes in total. And while U.S. bases in the Middle East were placed on higher alert, those bases were not given a heads up.
Do we know anything else about how effective the strikes were?
Well, they said the damage assessment is ongoing, but it will take a while to get a better assessment based on intelligence. President Trump, of course, said the sites were obliterated, but it appears, again, the assessment is ongoing. Of course, analysts have long said that even with such strikes, you can't completely end an Iranian nuclear ambition. So again, what is the way ahead? The U.S. is clearly at war with Iran. In the past, the U.S. has hit oil platforms, but never Iran proper. So does this continue?
What about potential repercussions here, Tom, and the regional implication for U.S. bases and the people serving there?
Oh, it's a huge concern. And Hegseth said if Iran hits any of these bases, the U.S. will reply with even greater attacks. There are some 40,000 U.S. troops in the region, and including Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq, and Syria among them. 5 years ago, during Trump's first administration, the U.S. assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Iran responded with a ballistic missile attack on the Al-Asad air base in Iraq. That led to dozens of concussions for U.S. forces. The U.S. was able to give those service members a 5 minute or so warning, allowing them to go into shelter. So it's possible you could see such attacks, or maybe Iranian militias operating, especially in Iraq, may weigh in as well. We just don't know at this point.
That's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Congressional Cemetery here in Washington dates back to 1807, making it one of the city's oldest burial grounds. It's also home to perhaps the only community-created LGBTQ plus section in the world, a resting place for a number of trailblazers. Matt Blitz takes us there.
It's a misty Saturday early summer morning in Southeast D.C. We're at Congressional Cemetery, so-called because it used to be the burial ground for congressmen who died while in office. Oblong-shaped stone markers and squat sandstone blocks line the walkway of the old cemetery, which is owned by a local parish. Among the thousands of gravestones, a group of about 20 visitors are quietly contemplating the arc of history.
Having a same-sex couple in a stone was a really bold thing to do in the 80s and 90s.
That's Docent Jeff Rollins, who's leading us through what some affectionately call Gay Corner, a small section of the 35-acre cemetery that is the internal resting place for some of the most important figures in the fight for LGBTQ plus rights. There's Barbara Giddings, the mother of the modern gay rights movement, Rhodes Scholar Alan Locke, and the first publicly out member of the military, Leonard Matlevich.
He enlisted to fight in the Vietnam War. He served three tours of duty. He got the Bronze Medal and the Purple Heart. And he was a very exemplary soldier.
In 1975, Matlevich came out dramatically on Time magazine's cover with the headline, "I'm a homosexual." He was honorably discharged from the Air Force. And it's because of Matlevich that this section came to be. The Vietnam War veteran chose Congressional Cemetery due to the proximity to his home and as a symbolic alternative to Arlington National Cemetery. He purposely selected a spot near FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who was notorious for targeting those he suspected to be gay. And in the five decades since, dozens of individuals have chosen to be buried right near Matlevich. Many of the gravestones are dotted with symbols of LGBTQ plus pride, from rainbow flags to upside down pink triangles. A.J. Orlikoff is Congressional Cemetery's executive director.
You can quite literally chart the evolution of what being gay meant in America through the gravestones that are here.
But for some, walking among the stones is more than just a stroll through the past. It's a window into today. D.C. residents Allison and Caleb Hoke are celebrating their five-year wedding anniversary. Allison says they came on this tour as a way to celebrate their love, but also to gain some perspective.
I think that's kind of what's really striking me, is just how much we have changed and grown as a community in such a short amount of time, and how much we have continued to fight and how it's still happening.
In recent months, the Trump administration has issued a series of executive orders targeting this community, particularly those who identify as transgender and non-binary. It has put many on edge. Jeff Rollins has led this tour for 8 years, but this is the first time he's done it since the federal government issued these recent orders.
We're seeing some of the similar language and attacks that were used on the LGBT community back then that we haven't seen in a while.
Allison Hope keeps reflecting on the choice Leonard Matlevich and others made to be buried here, in the nation's capital, among their community, and with pride.
It's a way to kind of reach across time to people in the future and say, like, there are people here who existed, they were like you. I just feel like that's really beautiful.
Allison hopes 50 years in the future, people will be able to stand in this spot, in this cemetery, and breathe a sigh of relief, because they don't have to fight anymore for their rights. For NPR News, I'm Matt Blitz.
This is NPR News.
National parks bring in a lot of tourism dollars, especially in the summer.
Everybody that comes to my motel goes to the park. So the park is everything to us.
But with the National Park Service facing budget cuts, business owners near parks are worried. We visit Joshua Tree National Park on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Iran fired missiles at Israel early this morning. Israeli medics say at least 23 people were wounded. The strikes were apparently in response to U.S. attacks on Iran overnight. U.S. military officials say the strikes destroyed three Iranian nuclear sites. The investigation continues into yesterday's crash of a hot air balloon in southern Brazil. Eight people were killed when the balloon caught fire and plunged to the ground. And in professional basketball, the NBA championship will be decided tonight in Oklahoma City. The Oklahoma City Thunder and the Indiana Pacers have tied that series at three games each. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Last night, the U.S. intervened in the conflict between Israel and Iran. American forces attacked three Iranian nuclear sites with bombers and a submarine. President Trump announced the strikes on his social media platform and claimed the sites were quote-unquote obliterated. But we're still working to confirm the full scope of the damage. We've got lots more details elsewhere in this program, and be sure to stay tuned to this station for expert assessment of the strikes, independent analysis, and reaction from the region, the world, and from here in the U.S. Tonight in Oklahoma City, the final game in the NBA championship. A win for either team, the Oklahoma City Thunder or the Indiana Pacers, would be their first. Member station KOSU's Abigail Sikowski brings us this from the host city and Thunder fans.
This year's NBA championship has been coined the small market finals. And in Oklahoma City, Thunder fans like Alexi Smith are excited to prove small markets can make it in the big leagues.
It's a showing that we're not like the little brother anymore. People may think of us as like cowboy hats and no big tall buildings, right? But there's a lot more going on in Oklahoma City. One big way to tell the entire nation that is to have your team win it all.
Smith is a bartender at the Goose, a sandwich shop and bar in Oklahoma City. They've been hosting rooftop viewings during the Thunder's NBA Finals run. And the Goose is not the only business booming during the playoffs. There are plenty of tourists here, too. Michael Angelis is an Oklahoman who now lives in Texas, which has several major league sports teams. He came here to experience the magic of Game 7 on Thunder turf.
I'm from Houston right now. Moved over to Houston, and it's just not the same. I don't know, it's not the same feeling. Like here, it's just like you feel like you're a part of a community, and I don't know, it really means a lot.
As Oklahoma City's only Big Four professional sports team, the OKC Thunder is a big deal not just for basketball fans, but for the entire city. Michael Leon was never a big basketball fan, but he is a big fan of his city and now cheers loudly for its team.
I think what is an amazing thing about the Oklahoma City Thunder is that we are one of the only teams in the league that chant our city as opposed to the name of the basketball team. And I think that's a testament to the people that we are. It's not just about basketball for us. It's about something more.
OKC! OKC! OKC!
He'll be cheering on his team and his city tonight. And if they win, he'll do one more thing. Celebrate. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Sikowski in Oklahoma City.
Summer is here and it's time for sitting in front of the TV. Well, turns out there are a ton of interesting TV shows airing over the next few months. There's everything from a new take on an armored superhero to a third season of Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and TV's most compelling serial killer returns, which will be a surprise to fans who thought he was killed at the end of his last TV series 3 years ago.
Somebody once told me, you have to go through hell to achieve resurrection. Hallelujah.
That's Michael C. Hall as the serial killer of killers, Dexter Morgan. His return in the Showtime series Dexter Resurrection is just one of several shows highlighted by NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans in a summer TV preview on NPR.org. He's here now to talk about them with us. Hi, Eric.
I know you're a big Dexter fan,
yes.
So yeah, we're going to have fun talking about that.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So first off, it seems like summer wouldn't be a great time for TV watching because everybody's on vacation or out in the nice weather. Why do you think we're seeing so many high-profile shows airing right now?
Well, you know, I think the TV industry has kind of moved away from those old-school cycles where we saw major shows come in the fall and the winter, and then the summer would just be where we see reruns and also-rans. Every streaming service and programmer kind of has its own internal logic for why it releases shows when it does. For example, FX always releases new seasons of its hit dramatic comedy, The Bear, towards the end of June, which means we get to binge watch one of TV's best shows right at the start of the summer.
Well, I want to get to that in 1 minute, but let's talk about a big show that's debuting on Tuesday from Marvel Television called Ironheart.
Yeah, so this series features Dominique Thorne as Riri Williams, a character that superhero movies fans first saw in Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Now, Riri is this young black tech genius. She's smart enough to build her own superhero-style battle armor like Iron Man. And in this 6-episode streaming series on Disney Plus, we get to see her after the events of that film. Back in America, she's feeling a little adrift and she's frustrated over how the world has overlooked her.
How come you're not working at one of those fancy tech firms?
After my internship abroad, I want to build something undeniable, something
important,
iconic.
So, of course, that iconic thing she wants to build is a version of the armor, but she falls in with some questionable people. Black Panther and Sinners director Ryan Coogler's on board as an executive producer, and the story is set in black and brown communities in Chicago, which I think really lifts up the story.
Let's talk about The Bear, which debuts the day after Ironheart. What can we look forward to there?
Well, I think The Bear is facing a bit of a backlash. It was the darling of the TV industry for its first two seasons, but its third season last year wasn't liked as well by some critics who questioned whether a show whose best moments always seem like a drama should even be called a comedy in these award shows like the Emmys or the Golden Globes. So the fourth season debuts Wednesday, and it drops all its episodes at once. It's continuing the story of Carmi Borzato, who's this driven chef played by Jeremy Allen White. He's converted his family's greasy spoon sandwich shop in Chicago into a fine dining establishment. And in the fourth season, he's trying hard just to keep the place open.
People go to restaurants to be taken care of, to relax, to not have to think about anything else for a minute. It's hard and it's brutal, and that's what makes it special.
So, you know, I always say shows like this succeed by creating characters you care about and performances you can't stop watching. And even when it slips, I think The Bear has always managed that pretty well.
We don't have much time left, but you've got to tell us about the return of Dexter and how he returns, if you can tell us that, and anything else on your radar.
Oh, yeah. So fans saw Dexter get shot by his son Harrison at the end of that 2022 series Dexter New Blood. Well, he survived, and eventually he tracks down Harrison in New York, where he also runs into this mysterious mogul played by Peter Dinklage in this new series called Dexter Resurrection, which debuts July 13th on Showtime. Now, since I'm a science fiction nerd, I'm also excited to see the third season of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. This is centered on the adventures of the crew of the Starship Enterprise before James Kirk was its captain, and it returns July 17th on Paramount Plus. And for fans of the Alien franchise, Noah Hawley, who's the creator of the Fargo TV series, has created this show for FX called Alien Earth. We see a deep space research vessel crashing on Earth in 2120, It likely has a few super dangerous life forms, like maybe a xenomorph if you're really a nerd like me. And that debuts August 12th on Hulu.
That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A tale as old as time, a story just like mine. You've been hurt by those who are supposed to treat you right.
At a moment where discord and division may feel like the norm in the world, music artist Marina says she wants to embrace love. And in her new album, Princess of Power, she doesn't shy away from some painful moments in her past.
Growing up, I kind of got this message that to be like open-hearted or loving was maybe to be weak in some way. But I think in the last few years, I've really learned to redefine love for myself in a completely different way and ultimately see that actually our ability and capacity to love is the most powerful thing about ourselves. It's not our weakness or vulnerability. So that's what Princess of Power means to me. Been living in quite like a masculine-led world for so long. Many of us have equated power with control, manipulating people to get our needs met. That isn't loving to me. So I think I've had to, over the last decade really, I've had to like work out what love means for myself, particularly in relationships too, because I think a lot of our behaviors in relationships are actually more like attachment-based to keep ourselves feeling secure. But that's kind of a separate thing to what actual love is.
It sounds like your idea of power is focusing on self and letting go of other people and maybe expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're totally right. We all have expectations when it comes to love and treatment of other people, but the reality is that you can't control anyone, and actually no one is obligated to love you.
Sometimes people gonna let you down. Not everybody's meant to stick around.
Whether it's a parent or sibling or a partner, that's quite a hard thing to accept. But through that process of analyzing these experiences and like parts of myself, I've like got to this stage where I just feel so much freer and I suffer less in my brain as well as a result. Love is important and partnership is important, but also feeling whole within yourself is as well. And I think I come to relationships from a very different place now.
Ago, you shared that you were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, which results in extreme exhaustion. How does that work for a pop star who's traveling around the world and you have all this energetic music and it has to be energetic concerts? How do you cope?
Well, I'm happy to say that I'm pretty much fully recovered. It's taken about 2 years, actually. For me, I understood it as a nervous system issue. So I started to do things like breath work every single day, like 40 minutes a day. It was a real lesson for me and was kind of a gift in the end because I've been able to change other aspects of my life through recovering from this.
There are some vulnerable moments on the album and you really open up. There's a song called Adult Girl.
I can let go of the flower, now my power has returned. I can look back at the past, now I see what I have learned. Try my best at my age, but the child won't behave. She wants to scream and cry and rage, and who am I to dig her grave? The
There's so much pain there for that inner child.
Yeah, I mean, it is a song about pain, but it's also
about really letting go of the past. I think the thing is understanding and having compassion for generational trauma. So for me, I'm saying I'm an adult girl, which is that I developmentally sometimes don't feel like I'm in adulthood.
Is the thought that you didn't get to have a childhood, you know, were you in the music business back then or?
Oh my God, no, I came to it very late. I was like 20 when I wrote my first song. But yeah, I think, it's not that I didn't have a childhood, but I think there were like stresses there that impacted me later on. But, you know, I always kind of hold it in balance that very few people have a perfect childhood, and life is about being challenged in different ways. And when I started to see things more as like a lesson that maybe my soul needed to learn, as opposed to I didn't get this, or like I wish my childhood had been like this, that kind of softened things a lot and just helped me to accept things for what they are. It's one of those human things that we actually grow the most in times of challenge. And like whenever I've been through a tricky period in life, I almost never regret having gone through it. After the fact, I can see the benefits of the growth that I was able to take away from it.
With this album, what do you want the people that listen to it, how do you want them to be empowered, and who do you hope will be empowered when they listen to this album?
I honestly, it sounds so simple, but I just want people to feel really good when they hear the records. And I do hope it empowers people for sure. Really, it's about shifting like negative feelings to positive feelings. I think we really need that in the world right now. There's like a lot of dark energy. So I think being able to put ourselves in a frame of mind that doesn't feed into like that fear is really needed.
That's music artist Marina. She has a new album out. It's called Princess of Power. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I want to make my way around town. Pink and purple, blue and gold. Get a cat suit, vintage clothes. Get on stage, take a bow. Marry me, let's make a vow. Gin martini, smoking vogues. Let's make a party of our own.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Gonna tell you tonight.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.